The first is John Rawls, who composed A Theory of Justice. And Rawls, probably the most influential 20th century liberal political philosopher, he argued that, you know, when we're concerned with questions of justice, that we ought to imagine a Congress of people who have come together at a constitutional convention in order to agree on how society ought to be run and according to what principles. And the sort of twist in the thought experiment is that all of these people are amnesiacs, which is to say they have forgotten their station in life and they've forgotten their background and their prejudices and their biases. They've forgotten everything about who they were. And now they have to plan a world in which they could end up as anyone. And at a convention such as that, Rawls argues, essentially, he would expect people to agree upon two things. One would be that we should create a society that recognizes and foregrounds some basic liberties, like freedom of conscience, the freedom to vote, okay, various due process, freedom of speech, et cetera. We would all agree that we ought to create a society like that. But he says that the other thing that people would likely agree upon would be that any inequality or difference in wealth outcomes should only be tolerated if those income differences and wealth differences would somehow benefit the worst off members of society. And these two sets of agreements, Rawls says, are interrelated in the sense that he calls this the principle of priority. So for instance, even if we decided that it would be beneficial to the worst off in society to negate the freedom of speech, that it would still be unjust to do so. In other words, everyone's liberties would need to be protected in order to establish a system that benefits the worst off. That's sort of the conclusion he arrives at. There are lots of people, liberals, and I don't mean in terms of political party affiliation, but liberals in the sense of the classical doctrine and the classical political philosophy of liberalism that really emphasizes the idea that the law is the gateway to civil liberties, amongst other core values. Most liberals, they accept Rawls's argument. There are some chief criticisms. Nowhere does Rawls really ask the question, what kind of life should a human being lead? What is a good life for a human being? That kind of question doesn't really enter into his thinking in a strong or robust way. And others, I might even argue that that's a central question from the perspective of justice. You know, what kind of world do we want to live in is an important question. And to put both of those questions together in a context, is it even possible to lead a good life in a bad world? Theodor Adorno, the Frankfurt School critical theorist of the 1950s and 60s, that was the question that really guided him in his thinking. And in particular, in his well-known book, Minima Moralia, he asked whether or not it's even possible to lead a good life in a bad world, which is to say a world in which the structural conditions upholding that life are flawed in some deep way. Those kinds of questions don't enter into Rawls's thinking about justice. And so you could say there's a potential criticism there. On the other hand, you have Nozick, who wrote another famous book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. And Nozick's approach to questions of justice is to say basically that individuals have immutable rights, which is to say rights that one can never violate justly. And principally, he argues that these rights consist in the idea that it's never right to injure a person or to take away their property for any reason except with their consent, unless it is absolutely necessary to do so in order to protect someone else in their welfare and in their property. And then the question for Nozick was, is it possible to have a state that recognizes this basic principle? Is that even possible? He says, yes, but the only state that he can envision acknowledging this principle of justice is a minimal one. He calls it a night watchman state that exists simply to protect property, but that the state really can't legitimately do more than that. For instance, he argues that the state shouldn't be able to tax people for any purpose other than to provide a police force or to protect private property. So you can see how this is very much at odds with the argument that Rawls makes. Rawls, in his theory of justice, very much is concerned with equality, whereas Nozick prioritizes freedom over equality. In fact, under Nozick's theory, a great degree of inequality will be tolerable so long as free exchange is established and protected. Basically, Nozick argues that what you own justly, so long as it was voluntarily given. That's the only important parameter guiding the extent to which ownership and property can be considered just. So anything that is taken away without one's consent, including all kinds of taxation policies and plans, will be considered problematic. Now, there's also, of course, criticisms of this argument. Perhaps one of the more interesting critiques that you see that have developed over the course of the last 50 years have to do with the example of a famous basketball player. Like, take LeBron James, for instance, right? You could tax 50% of what LeBron James earns. He makes many millions of dollars every year. You might tax him at a 50% rate in order to redistribute his income and balance equality with freedom in a given society. Now, Nozick would claim that that's an unjust form of interference with liberty, with James's liberty. But on the other hand, to say that that kind of interference is the same as a type of interference, for instance, that would prevent people from being able to pay to watch LeBron James play, right? To say that those two are the same kind of interference with liberty is problematic. So this is a critique of Nozick that argues that not all forms of interference are akin to dictatorship. So there's your binary.
You should correct me if I'm wrong about this assumption, but like the way that you describe them, and from what I understand between their differences, you could do worse than using those two perspectives as shorthand for the political divide between Democrats and Republicans in like 2021. I guess I see that dynamic playing out repeatedly and consistently in DC, in the state of Alaska, between these visions of what government should be, maybe not realistic portrayals of what government currently is, but at least like sort of ideals the different parties want their visions to look like. I think Rawls' theory of justice, it reminds me, you know, this vision of government either protecting or expanding liberty and rights and say-so, actually, like power, to greater numbers and portions of the population, versus Nozick might reasonably say that we could select and award a section, or at least be okay with awarding a section of society at whatever de facto definition of the top, those who make the most money, those who have the most free time or are the most educated or engaged. These are all mostly the people with the most resources, that we could award them or say so. And that's sort of what de facto happens when there's not an active role of government in terms of like lifting the worst off, as it seems like Rawls is focused on protecting the worst off and redistributing resources to the worst off, or to ensure that they continue to have an equal amount or a comparable amount of power. And I guess I think about this, especially right now, when it comes to like voting rights. HR1, which passed the House, the Democratic controlled House in DC recently, and which is now, I think, up to and available to the Senate. So just let me set the stage here for a second. As we've discussed on this program before, 2020, general election 2020, was the most open, I think by any definition, was the most open, the most well-attended election that we've had in the United States in at least a very long time. In terms of raw numbers, it's the most people who have ever voted in the United States. And even percentage-wise, it's the most people who have voted in something like 100 years. And you could chalk that up to a few things, you know, passions were very high. But I guess I think that this is, and there seems like there's evidence that this is mostly because of expanded voting methods and timelines meant to counteract the potential for COVID to keep people at home. I think that everybody was kind of in agreement. That's why voting access was expanded to such a remarkable degree last year. 63% of the total votes cast in 2020 were cast before Election Day, either by mail or you know, in-person early voting. Now, today, sort of, you know, in this new Congress, the Republicans in many states, potentially including Alaska, actually, Senator Mike Schauer from Wasilla has introduced a bill to limit by-mail voting in the state of Alaska. But across the United States, state governments have sort of an unprecedented number of bills in front of them that they're voting on, trying to roll back many of the methods that led to that record turnout in 2020. And I guess what's fascinating to me is that this kind of landscape of states kind of taking these unprecedented actions to limit or roll back some of these like voting methods is actually what might be necessary. It seems like there's signals now that that's actually what might be necessary to break or at least severely weaken the filibuster at the federal level in the Senate, and would also weaken or break apart the Republicans, what I think is effectively right now the Republicans' minority control over the main legislative levers in the Senate. Joe Manchin has signaled that this is the one issue that might budge him on reforming or ending the filibuster. And Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, has signaled that, the Republicans are worried about this, I think, which is plainly clear from his bluster. If Mitch McConnell thought that killing the filibuster was actually good for the Republicans, I think he would probably be quiet and just let it happen. And that's not what's being communicated. And if the filibuster actually benefits a GOP-controlled Senate, in my opinion, then it would be true that the filibuster is anti-democratic even then, and it would lead to a more Democratic outcome, Democratic small d, not like Democratic Party. Democratic outcome, even if it were weakened or eliminated. So I see that division or that debate between Rawls and Nozick that Alex was talking about before. I see that sort of manifest in a repeated and consistent way in many different forms. And I think that even in the state of Alaska, I think that it will be quite interesting, you know, if they actually weaken or if they do away with the filibuster entirely, I think it'd be sort of a new era when it comes to DC politics.
Nate Bauer directs the University of Alaska Press, and Alexander Hirsch is a political scientist at UAF. I'm Robert Hannon.